from KQED.
This is the California Report podcast. I'm Lily Jamali in San Francisco.
And I'm John Sepulvedo in San Diego. And just a little bit up the road from me, we are seeing some progress in negotiations between the Los Angeles Unified School District and the union that represents teachers. You might remember that teachers have been on strike for the past, 8 days or so. There is still no agreement, but the office of Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti says the latest bargaining session has lasted 21 hours and ended earlier this morning. The mayor's office says negotiators plan to reconvene at 9:15 a.m. For picketing teachers, that means no paycheck. And for many parents, that means a patchwork of childcare. Kaylee Wells has more on how both groups are preparing if the strike continues much longer.
Teachers hope continued strong turnouts on the picket line and low school attendance, which costs LAUSD money, will pressure the district to make an offer soon. Some school communities are coming up with childcare alternatives. Parent Alan Canterbury says he had to go back to work after taking 3 days off to march with a school-age daughter, but he's keeping her out of school to support her teachers.
Our school actually has started a co-op at a local church where parents are able to drop off their kids.
He says the co-op plans to continue childcare through the end of the strike. As for teachers, their first paycheck since the strike began doesn't hit until early next month. But second grade teacher Tara Lowry says she would ask for help to make ends meet before crossing the picket line.
I would probably ask my father or my in-laws and just be like, could you loan us a little bit?
The sticking points are about more than pay. Superintendent Austin Buettner said in a press conference Friday that the district doesn't have the money to meet all the union's demands, such as smaller class sizes and more support staff. The district couldn't provide anyone for an interview as negotiations continue. For the California Report, I'm Kaylee Wells in Los Angeles.
Shares of PG&E are spiking this morning after they told federal regulators that they have secured billions of dollars in financing to shore up its operations during a bankruptcy. Now, that's important because, as we learned last week, they intend to file for Chapter 11 at the end of this month. And what this does is essentially signal to the world that they are serious about doing that. Now, bear in mind that PG&E shares have lost most of their value since November's campfire in Butte County. But there's a hedge fund in Manhattan that has kept on buying through all of this. It now has a 2% stake and a whole lot to lose if PG&E enters bankruptcy protection. So they're making a very public case that filing for bankruptcy doesn't make sense. Here's our exclusive interview with Omar Vishnavi, head of fundamental credit at Blue Mountain Capital Management.
What's happened to the people of Northern California is a terrible outcome. Our heart goes out to those victims, and we think it's a large tragedy. The victims deserve a fair process and everything they're entitled to under law, and we believe a bankruptcy won't do that. What I'd like to point out is that the company themselves has said publicly that they have enough liquidity to avoid a bankruptcy for a while. What they believe is that a bankruptcy is in the best interest of all stakeholders. But what's important is that bankruptcy is bad for all stakeholders who are involved. This includes ratepayers, wildfire victims, and other people in California.
Now, PG&E says it's facing a potential liability of $30 billion for the 2017 and 2018 California wildfires alone. One of the arguments against an immediate bankruptcy is that there's no rush.
So from a timing perspective, there hasn't been a single judgment issued against the company from the 2017 or 2018 wildfire claims. Many of them are in pre-trial orders, which could take a few years. Even when a decision happens against the company in the future, the company could appeal that decision, which means that these cases could go on for 4 or 5, even up to 10 years, we've seen in some cases.
You also say entering into bankruptcy protection could erode any goodwill that's left among legislators, for example, who have the potential to really help PG&E out right now. Why do you think, then, that PG&E is pursuing this path?
We believe the people and politicians of California have been very patient with the company, and the company has harmed its goodwill with them. They haven't gone far enough with changes to management and governance to restore that faith in the business. Many of the advisors to the company stand to benefit significantly from a financial perspective in bankruptcy. We urge them to consider getting disinterested advisors to come in and provide advice, people who wouldn't be used after bankruptcy.
And that was Omar Vishnavi, partner at Blue Mountain Capital Management, all the way in Manhattan, but taking a very keen interest in the happenings around this PG&E bankruptcy. John, on this note, I'm going to be headed to Sacramento this morning to speak with Assemblyman Jim Patterson, who is the vice chair of the Utilities Committee. We're going to talk about that issue, the goodwill. Is there any left for PG&E, who, by the way, I talked to them on email last night. They're sticking with their line that there are no other viable options here.
Well, you know, and I might not know much about finance. Anybody who would check my credit score would see that. But I wonder if this guy is motivated by the fact that he owns 2.5% of the company, whether that is playing into his desire to see the PG&E not file for bankruptcy, more so than how he feels about the victims.
Well, without a doubt, he has a lot of skin in the game here. Absolutely. 2% at a time when a lot of others were fleeing this investment, they were doubling down. And it's interesting because in a bankruptcy, what would happen is there's a pecking order in terms of who gets paid, and shareholders are at the very bottom of that pecking order.
Let's step away for a moment then from PG&E and talk about other things that state lawmakers are considering, including a debate on whether clinics at UC and CSU campuses should provide medication abortions. These, of course, are the so-called abortion pills. If passed, California would be the first state in the country to require public universities to provide abortion pills. KQED's April Domboski reports.
Jessie Rosales was a sophomore at UC Riverside. She had a boyfriend, and she was taking birth control pills. Then out of nowhere, she started feeling sick.
Turns out that I was pregnant.
Rosales was clear that she was not ready to have a baby. The clinic gave her a list of three places off campus where she could get an abortion. Rosales wanted a medication abortion, where she'd take one pill at the clinic and a second one at home to induce a miscarriage.
I just wanted that intimacy of dealing with it on my own, just being able to curl up in my bed right away.
But the first clinic she called didn't do abortions. The second didn't take her insurance. By the time she could get an appointment at a third clinic, she was already into her second trimester, too late for a medication abortion. She had to have a surgical one.
The doctor kept telling me to relax, and I couldn't because it just hurt so bad.
Now Rosales is advocating for a bill that would make it easy for students to get a medication abortion on state campuses. Researchers estimate that could be as many as 500 women a month. Private women's groups would pay for all the upfront equipment and training costs, but it's unclear if universities would eventually need to dip into their own budgets for ongoing costs.
No campus abortions!
Critics say that's not fair to students who oppose abortion.
Just by attending school and paying student fees, they would be paying for abortion.
Anna Bach is the Northern California coordinator for Students for Life of America. She says abortion providers are already near state campuses, 6 miles on average, according to a recent study in the Journal of Adolescent Health. Bach says that's an easy Uber ride away.
We were questioning why their solution was to bring abortion on to campus rather than providing transportation.
Governor Jerry Brown vetoed an earlier version of this bill last year, saying it wasn't necessary. At the time, Gavin Newsom said he would have supported the bill. For the California Report, I'm April Domboski.
All right, we're going to end today on something that happened on Twitter. Well, it happened on the internet.
No, it definitely happened.
Sonia, can you just wait a minute before I introduce you?
Oh, sorry.
That's Sonia Hudson, of course, who is our intrepid producer. Lily, while you were busy breaking stories, talking to the people who own PG&E, Sonia and I were goofing around on the microphone yesterday, and we said that somehow because you have a J in your name, Sonia, right? That's how it all came up?
Yeah, I do. We both have J's in our name.
Okay.
And John, you said, wow, we're basically the same person because we both have J's in our name. And I was like, oh my God, totally.
A very John Sepulveda thing to say.
Yeah, it actually doesn't, it makes no sense at all, but that's why he said it.
Yeah.
And so then for some reason, what popped into my mind was like a cross stitch with John and I's names overlapped at the J because like that's what makes us the same. And a listener replied to that, And a listener replied to us on Twitter and just with a very casual how's this? And then she posted a photo of an actual cross stitch that she did with my exact vision on it. And it says the California Report support public radio and has a little picture of a bear with a microphone that looks like our logo.
The listener's name is Emily. You can find her at Odessa Blue. Hi, Emily. We're going to come. And one of the things, reasons that we did this was because talking nonsensically, as I often do during this portion of the podcast, I had said, oh, we'll come and visit anyone who cross-stitches that, thinking no one's going to listen to this podcast and no one's going to cross-stitch it. Emily took us up on that. So next month, Sonia and I are going to take Emily to lunch. Lily, you can join if you want, if you're not too busy being all big pants, breaking stories and stuff.
And Emily, we are so excited to meet you, and thank you so much for stitching this for us. It means the world to know that people listen to the show and care this much about it.
That's true. That is true.
So true. So true.
We should also mention that Oscar nominations are out. Of course, that's a big Los Angeles event.
Are you going to make me talk about pop culture now, John?
No, I know you have to go bust another story, Oprah, wide open, Lily. So Sonia and I will handle this. I saw The Favorite. Have you all seen this movie?
No, I haven't, but I've been really wanting to because I love Emma Stone.
I love Emma Stone, too. And so did Queen Anne of England, or that's the character that is played. It's a fight between Emma Stone's character and another character over the Queen of England, Anne's affection. And it's a really interesting, it's from the same director who did The Lobster. It's not as surreal if anyone saw that movie, but it's really, really interesting, and how the movie ends leaves you very unsettled and unsatisfied, which is, I think, what he was going for. So that's interesting. Vice. Have you all seen Vice?
No. Now you're just embarrassing my lack of cultural knowledge, which is extra embarrassing because I live like three blocks from a movie theater.
Answer to all of the have you seens will be no. For me. Okay. Just get that out there right now.
It's easier for me to say the movies that I have seen versus the ones I haven't. The list is
How about
much
if
shorter.
We talk about Bohemian Rhapsody, because I actually do have something to contribute to that conversation.
Let's do that.
I haven't, once again, I have not seen it. But there is a reason. There's a reason. I just cannot bring myself to see it. If there were any movie this year that I would have gone and seen in the theater, that would have been it.
Wait, so why don't you want to see it?
I don't want to muss my image of Freddie Mercury, who is a little bit of an idol. I'll just put it out there.
Yeah, it's weird. Lily has a tattoo of Freddie Mercury's face on her arm.
And, like, on my face.
Up to her neck. Yeah, on her. Jokes, dude, jokes. Lily Jamali reminding everyone, I guess, that you're too busy working to watch movies, and Sonia's too busy. What do you do all day, Sonia?
I'm working too, and
she
avoiding the movie
too.
Theater near my house.
Well, I'm the only person who's not working, and I am John Sepulvedo.
And I'm Lily Jamali, and
I'm Sonia Hudson. Have a great day.
Support for the California Report comes from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose Fund for Strategic Innovation supports transformative ideas that benefit humanity while protecting the natural world, recognizing through science the interdependence of all living systems. The James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. And Collective Health. American employers are in the healthcare business. It's time they had the technology to drive it. CollectiveHealth.com.